Whose image is in you? This is one of my favorite stories. I got it originally from the late Reverend George Watt, who used to be at Victoria, so I'll give him all the credit for it. There was a church where a preacher and the minister of music, I almost said worship leader, but I better not, were not getting along in their congregation. And as time went on, the hostility began to spill over into the church service, with the minister of music making life incredibly difficult for the preacher. One week, the minister got up and preached about commitment and how we should dedicate ourselves to the Lord. And the music director led the final hymn in response to the message with, "I shall not be moved." The next week, the minister preached on tithing and how we should all gladly give to the work of the Lord. And the music director led the great hymn, "Jesus Paid It All." Next week, the minister preached on the evils of gossiping and how we should all watch our tongues, to which the music director led in response, "I love to tell the story." With this going on, the preacher was getting totally disgusted over the situation, and the following Sunday, he got up and told his congregation that he was considering resigning, to which the music director led the hymn, "Oh, Why Not Tonight?" As it came to pass, the pastor had finally had enough and did resign. The next week he informed the congregation that it was Jesus who led him there, and now it was Jesus who was taking him away, to which the music director played, "What a friend we have in Jesus." You know, one of the phrases that gets bandied about every time we have an election, federal, provincial, whatever, is this concept of hidden agenda. Do you know that phrase? I take this phrase, hidden agenda, used in recent elections to mean that people believe that one or maybe all the political leaders and their parties tell the public one thing, but secretly have plans that they will carry out if they were elected. These secret plans, it seems, are such that they would have been received negatively by the populace or the voting public should they have been known in advance of the polls. The problem with secret agendas is, well, they're hidden if they exist at all, right? Sometimes we can tell, can't we, when someone's hidden agenda and what it's all about. Like the story I just shared about the music director and the little story as they tried to force the minister out. But other times, we're just not sure what someone's agenda really is. It's also very difficult, as Premier Doug Ford has experienced recently, for someone who is accused of having a hidden agenda to prove that they don't possess one. How do you prove you don't have something that is inherently secret? The truth is that people do, by our human nature, have hidden agendas. We do. In most of our encounters with other people, even in the church itself, we all secretly want to achieve something that is to the benefit of ourselves or those we represent. There is in most of our human interactions a seething undercurrent of suspicion and sometimes even hostility, because we assume that we're not getting the whole story or that we're being sold a bill of goods. People will do almost anything if it leads to some sort of personal gain for them. Who cheats? Well, just about anyone if the stakes are right. Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner wrote a wonderful book years ago. They've actually had a second one since, called Freakonomics. I don't know how many of you have actually read. It's very, very interesting. And they point out this. You might say to yourself, "I don't cheat," regardless of the stakes. And then you remember the time you did cheat. Maybe in a board game. Sorry, Jordan. Or the golf ball that you just happened to kick into a better lie at the golf course. Or the time you really wanted that bagel from the office break room, but you couldn't come up with the dollar that you're supposed to put in the coffee can to pay for it. So you took the bagel anyway, promising that you'd pay double the next time, and you didn't do it. Now, some cheating, let's be honest, barely leaves any shadow of evidence, right? Other cases, though, the evidence is massive. This is what happened in 1987 when 7 million, you hear me right, 7 million American children suddenly disappeared. Have you heard about this? What happened? Was there some kind of terrible plague in the U.S. or some natural disaster that would wipe out 7 million children? No. It so happened that the Internal Revenue Service simply made a rule change in the tax forms that dependent children had to be claimed differently on the income tax form. Every child in the U.S. who is claimed as a dependent now had to have a Social Security number. So that means you got to submit a birth certificate. So suddenly, 7 million phantom children disappeared from being dependents. We all have hidden agendas. We manage them by cheating, by lying, by flattery, and a whole host of other tools. So when I read this story, a familiar story of Jesus being questioned by his critics, I may be disappointed at their motivation, but I'm hardly surprised. The Pharisees have been scheming for months to get rid of Jesus. And they believed that we finally came up with an ingenious plan, or at least they thought so. They sent their disciples, they didn't come themselves, they sent their disciples, along with some Herodians. They may be a group you're not familiar with. Herodians were monarchists who wanted the Jews to keep Herod on the throne, or the Romans to keep Herod on the throne. They came to Jesus to trap him. Now, they used a typical strategy when you're trying to trick somebody, didn't they? They start out by flattering Jesus. They tell him, "Oh, Jesus, you're so honest. You don't show partiality. You speak the truth no matter what the fallout is." I'm sure all of us in this room have had someone who's come up to us to try to butter us up before asking us for something. Like, "Gee, mummy, you look pretty today. And by the way, pretty mummy, can I have a cookie?" These Pharisee disciples, these wannabes, are hypocrites. They are being two-faced. They neither think Jesus is a teacher worthy of respect, nor do they seek an answer of any value at all. They are seeking to trap him. So they ask their, I love this, they ask their slippery question. Is it right to pay taxes to the Roman government or not? Now, if Jesus had answered that it was not right to pay taxes, the Herodians, remember they're standing there too, would go back and report to Jesus to the Romans saying he was a subversive, that he was a zealot. If Jesus said it was lawful, then the people who hated the Romans would turn against Jesus for being in compliance with their occupiers. It sounds like a pretty ingenious question, doesn't it? But we read further, Jesus saw through their trick, and he answered first with a demonstration. He took a coin, the one used to pay the taxes, called a denarii, and he asked his very famous question. Many of us have heard it many times. Whose picture is on this coin? Whose image? It was Caesar, of course. They minted them with his picture on it. And Jesus goes on to say that people should give to Caesar what belongs to him, but everything that belongs to God should be given to God. The scripture's going to tell us that the Pharisees' disciples, the Herodians also, were absolutely amazed by his answer. And it says they just walked away. They went away because their hidden agenda had failed. Now, One thing I got to tell you about this passage that has bothered me for a long time is how the modern church has used this passage. I'm sure all of us have been at some point in our lives to a church, have heard sermons that are based on this passage that speak to the rightful relationship of the secular government to religion. In other words, some people will try and use this passage to say that Jesus was making a political statement here. Perhaps you've even thought that this passage has something to say about whether paying taxes is a Christian thing to do. I've heard that too. I, however, see this passage as speaking to something completely different, at least as I come to it this time. Regardless of the financial implications of this passage, I think it's more to say, has more to say about our own hidden agendas than anything about taxation. Jesus uses the word hypocrite here to describe the hearts of those who are questioning him. I also think that a really appropriate word here to describe their hearts would be disingenuous. That means that they were insincere. Or they lack frankness. Both disingenuous and hypocrisy speak to that age-old human problem of being two-faced. We all know what that means, every one of us. Clearly it means we are saying one thing, but really believe or feel differently. Jesus was clearly offended by his critics' disingenuous hearts and words. The issue here, my friends, is not about taxes. It's not about coins. It's about the condition of our hearts. All of us have in life been frustrated by disingenuous people. And I'm going to add here that people have probably been disappointed with us for being disingenuous at times. We've all experienced people expressing thoughts or feelings we know are more than just substance or nothing more than just air being shot at us. One of my classic examples, I've used this many times with you, is, you know, we go up and we regularly ask someone, how you doing? Only to have them say what? I'm okay. I'm fine. And all you need to do is look at their eyes or their body language to know that they're nowhere near being okay. What is a very curious development in our society is when someone is actually frank and honest with us, we actually would prefer that if they go back to being disingenuous. The late comedian Don Rickles, I don't know how many of you remember him. He was known worldwide as the king of put-downs. In Las Vegas, he had a show there for a number of years, and people would regularly flock to see him in his act. They would come not just to see him or hear him, but they hoped to become part of the routine. One evening, Rickles was about 30 minutes into his act when a man and woman were escorted into the theater right down to the front row in front of him. And Rickles stopped and acknowledged the couple's entrance with, "Hey, Mr. and Mrs. Hockey Puck, you're 30 minutes late." But the man immediately shot back, "No, we're early. You're still on." They say that Rickles literally dropped to his knees in laughter, and the crowd gave the man a standing ovation. You know, frankness can be funny, but still hypocrisy is what reigns in our world, doesn't it? The hidden agendas in our hearts always trump what is good, what is right, what is true. I think that perhaps we have been just as disingenuous with Jesus as these critics were. Perhaps we too have approached him with great flattery, while all the while questioning his goodness. Perhaps we've offered lip service to the principles of faith that Christ espoused, only to go about secretly behaving as if Jesus has made no difference in our lives at all. Perhaps we've even been like those in the story today, and we've gone to great lengths to phrase tricky questions to excuse us as to why we don't believe in God or we don't follow Jesus. Every time I hear a skeptic drag out a centuries-old chestnut of reason they don't believe in the goodness of God or his existence, I know in my heart that for the most part, they're being disingenuous. It is disingenuous because often they don't really want an answer at all, but rather an excuse to avoid confronting their own lostness. That's the true hidden agenda in this passage and in all of our lives. Our desire to avoid or to distance ourselves from Jesus. We need to ask ourselves a very hard question today. Am I preserving an authentic relationship with Christ or simply preserving the appearance of a relationship? I'm sure that you would all agree with me that there's a world difference there. Tony Campolo, I tell stories about him all the time. He tells a story about a church service in a charismatic church where a woman stood up in the middle of the proceedings, not unusual in churches like that. She claimed to have a word of prophecy from the Lord. She stood in kind of a trance-like state, and when she spoke, she had an unnatural, heavy voice coming out of her. And everyone waited with intense anticipation, and she boldly declared, "Thus saith the Lord, even as Moses led the animals into the ark, even so shall I lead my people to safety if they trust me." Did you catch it? All through the congregation, there were murmurs as people leaned over to everybody and said, "Did she say Moses? I think she said Moses." And after delivering what was supposed to be a direct message from the Lord, the woman sat down. A couple minutes later, she stood up again. And again, supposedly in a trance and with that deep, sort of eerie voice belted out, "Thus saith the Lord, it wasn't Moses, it was Noah." And the whole place just erupted in giggles. So I wonder, hearing a story like that, what's she giving evidence to? None of us but the Lord himself knew what that woman's heart was all about. But as a casual observer, we instinctively know something's wrong here. Something's wrong with her faith, perhaps. I thought about a certain question for a very long time. What exactly does God want from his people? Now, I hope this is a question that you've asked yourself quite frequently, too. Quite often, the extent of my spiritual introspection centers on what I need to do at any given moment or in the face of certain circumstances. We even, remember, we saw a whole industry, maybe it's still going, that was built around that question, what would Jesus do, right? And so, people who know how to make money, they got into it. They made t-shirts and bracelets with bold letters, WWJD, inscribed boldly on them. It was in hopes of being reminded or reminding others that their first duty to Christ was to do as he did. I'm first to say I'm not going to discourage anyone from following Jesus' example. That's not what I'm getting at. But is the sum of our faith nothing more than simply doing Christ-like things? To me, it's just as disingenuous to say to Jesus, "Look what I've done," as it was to flatter him, trick him with a question. I honestly believe that what Jesus is looking for is an authentic relationship with his followers. Followers who don't resort to trying to manipulate Jesus like those who came to him that day with a question. Rather, followers who live in the assurance of Jesus' love. Followers who, Jesus wants followers who are honest with him about their faults, honest with him about their struggles and their doubts, and yet the faith journey continues anyway with him. There's no hidden agenda with Jesus. You notice that? He is the way, the truth, and the life, we're told. He will always tell you the truth about yourself and about this world. Always. Jesus will refuse to play politics with faith by trying to flatter you into the kingdom of God or by making the way to life wide, because he has said that the way is narrow. And because Jesus is so forthright in his actions and with his words, and because he refuses to play politics, he was eventually crucified. Truthful faith is costly. Centuries of church history have proven that to be true. But being disingenuous or hypocritical in one's faith can even be more costly, as we run the danger of Jesus saying to us at the end of all things, "Depart from me, I never knew you." And I'll be honest with you, I would far rather to be known by Christ than by anything or anyone else in this world.